This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The danger of transforming all the values of the Torah, both the spiritual values and the human values, into what could easily become meaningless formulas. And just as it's important not to have values without ways of expressing them, without a system, a method of expressing those values, because that would be meaningless. So we shouldn't have a system without the values, because that's empty. And the example we had was when Miriam was ill, when Miriam had tsaras, she had this disease which they call leprosy, and Aaron appeals to Moshe to intervene on her behalf. And the Torah tells us, Vayitzak Moshe el Hashem Reimor, and Moshe cried out to Hashem saying, and here the Torah is about to reveal to us a most personal and intimate tefillah we would expect. The tefillah of Moshe Rabbeinu, the head of Klal Yisrael, for the healing, for the refuah of his own sister. And yet there's a five-word impersonal tefillah. Kelno Rafonola. Ribono Shel Olam, please heal her. That's all he says. Why is he so brief? Explains Rashi. Shelo yeyu Yisrael Oimrim Achoisoi Omedes Betzora Vehu Omede Marbe Betfilo. So that Yisrael won't say, so that the Jewish people won't say, look at this, his sister's ill, his sister's suffering, and he's busy davening. So we asked last night, what's so terrible? What should he be doing? What could he be doing more productive than davening? She hasn't even got the disease, a normal kind of medical disease which could be cured by normal medical means. She's got a spiritual disease. She's got a disease whose cause is entirely spiritual. Even if it were a medical disease, what better could Moshe be doing than davening for her, than praying for her? And now that it's a spiritual disease, sure, that's the best thing that he could possibly be doing. So what would the validity be of such criticism from Yisrael when they would say, Achoisei omedes betzoro, v'hu omed emaybe betfilo? His sister is in tzoro, his sister is suffering, and he's busy davening. Sure he's busy davening. What could he be doing more productive? So we see it's not so simple that the most productive thing to be doing when somebody's in trouble is to be davening for them. What do they expect him to be doing? What should he be doing? There's a mitzvah of bikur chayli. There's a mitzvah to go and visit the sick person. There's a mitzvah to sympathize with the sick person, to empathize with the sick person, to do things to help the sick person. If he or she can't manage on her own, they need to be helped. That's all part of what a brother ought to be doing when his sister is in sorrow. Not just davening. So we see that just saying the formula isn't sufficient. It needs to be an act of chesed. The first thing is that there needs to be an act of empathy, there needs to be an act of identification. And even in the tefillah itself, we learned last night, even in the nature of the tefillah, what is the nature of the tefillah? How is one meant to pray for somebody else? We had the Medrash's lovely story of the gibber, the powerful man, the strong man, Shehayo HaKolo B'Tzavoro, who found himself in the unfortunate situation where his neck was in the stocks. His sentence was up eventually and he was released from that. A while later he walks past and he sees somebody else is in the stocks. And he started shouting and crying. They said to him, what are you crying about? You're out of there already. What are you crying about? You can't understand. I've been in his situation. I know what it feels like to be like that. I know what he's suffering. You can't understand what he's suffering. Kachayom Moshe tzaveach, in the same way Moshe was shouting. Amar la Hakadosh Baruch Hu, Malachot tzaveach, why are you shouting so much? Why are you crying so hard? Amar l'fom of Ribbono shel Olam, ani yodea beizet tzar hi nesuno, shani zochur hashalsheles shehoyso yodi l'soicha. I know how this lady is suffering, my sister, because I had my arm in Saras. I had leprosy on my arm once, just for a very short time, but I know what it feels like. And she's suffering leprosy all over her body. I can imagine, I can understand the suffering and the pain that she's going through, and I can feel that suffering. So we see that the degree of sympathy necessary even in tefillah, even when one's praying for somebody, never mind when one's going to help somebody, when one identifies with somebody, when there's a sense of chesed that has to be expressed towards somebody, even when there's a question of tefillah, even when it's a question of davening for somebody, what is the measure of empathy that there needs to be? The measure of empathy, says the Medrash, is you've got to feel as if it's you, as if it's your neck that's in the stocks. Then you can daven properly. Until you feel the same pain, until you can look at that person and say, I can feel exactly what that person's going through, I can suffer with that person, and that brings one to daven the same as you would daven for yourself. That's the point at which the davening becomes effective. That's the point at which the prayer becomes effective, and only at that point, when the person is really able to sympathize and empathize to the point where he's able to say, I knew your day, I know what that person's going through, I can feel what that person's going through. We explained last night how careful we have to be not to let our acts of interpersonal relationships and our relationships with the Ribbono Shel Olam slip in to a formalistic routine that denies us the essential feelings that the Torah really wants. Rachmona liba boy, the Torah wants the heart at the end of the day. Yeah, one can have the whole thing, whether one's yotze the mitzvah with kavona, without kavona, whether one can be yotze a mitzvah even if one didn't have full conscious intent, or one didn't. That's all a halakhic technical discussion. But in terms of the values of the Torah, Rachmona liba boy, the Ribbono Shel Olam wants you to feel the Torah, not just to do the Torah. And when one davens for somebody, the degree of feeling, the level of feeling, the level of identification has to be, it's as if I've had it myself. I'm able to feel as if it's me who's going through it, not somebody else. And then one can daven properly. That's what davening needs to be. That's how one prays for somebody. The question I want to deal with this evening is, how far does that identification go? That sense of identification. So we're meant to feel other people's sorrow. Who are the other people that we're meant to feel? We're meant to feel, if any of our close friends or relatives are in sorrow, we're meant to feel it. Good. Members of our community are in sorrow, we're meant to feel it. I can understand that too. If members of other communities, if there are Jews in other parts of the world who feel, who are suffering, I need to feel for them as well. Maybe as well, maybe also. What about the Bosnians and the Yugoslavians and the Somalians and the Ethiopians and the Chinese? Are we meant to feel that same kind of feeling for everybody? Is it expected and is it possible to feel a level of identification and empathy with everybody the way we feel it for one another? What are the gedurim? What yes and what no? To deal with that, I want to deal with a halacha that usually Rabbonim only deal with half of. There's a mitzvah that comes several times in the Torah, and it comes in our Sefer too. Av lo sashich le'ochicho neshech kesef neshech oicho. You may not charge your brother interest, whether you're lending him money or food. Neshech kol dover asher yishoch, or any other item that you might lend to him. The first halacha, one isn't permitted to charge interest on a loan. That part is difficult enough to deal with it, and we will deal with it. What's so terrible? The two parties agree to it. What's so terrible? If I'm facilitating somebody else's business by lending him money, and he's willing to charge me interest, and I'm to pay me interest, and I'm charging him less interest than he would pay anywhere else, less interest than he would pay at the bank, less interest than he would pay from any other source. Surely that's a chesed, surely I'm doing him a favor. And he's only too happy because he knows that he can make much more profits on the money than the interest I'm charging him. So he willingly goes into it. Why should it be such an issue? Why should it be so terribly wrong? That's the first difficult angle of the halacha. But the second part is the racist part of the halacha. La nechri sashich, ulachicha loy sashich. The Gentile, you may charge interest. And according to the Rambam, you must charge interest. The Jew, not. The man yivarechcho Hashem alakecha b'chol mishlach yodecho al ha'oretz, and so on, so that Hashem should bless you, and so on. And I want to deal also with that part of the halacha. Why it is that for the Gentile we may charge interest, and according to the Rambam, why it is that we must charge interest to the Gentile. That seems totally racist. And we need to understand that, and through that we'll understand some of the principles of identification. Let's start off with understanding a little bit about the prohibition of interest. Prohibition of interest means that if I lend you something, all you have to pay me back, all you're permitted to pay me back, is exactly what I lent you. And it doesn't matter if prices have changed. If I lend you a bag of sugar, and by the time you give me the bag of sugar back, prices have gone up. As long as I gave you a bag of sugar and you give me a bag of sugar, that's fine. Get the same value. If I lend you money, then irrespective of whether the value of money has decreased or hasn't decreased, you give me back in the same currency I paid you. I lent it to you, you give me back the same value. So if I give you 1,000 rand today, even though tomorrow that 1,000 rand will probably only be worth, who knows, 900 rand, 800 rand, 700 rand, who knows what it'll be worth tomorrow. If you pay me back tomorrow or next week or next month, you pay me back the same amount. So what you're paying me back, I can't buy, its buying power is less than it was when I lent it to you. That doesn't matter. The fact that while I gave the money to you, I had to pay for that. The fact is, I had that money on fixed deposit, and I was earning 6%, 7%, 8%, 10%, I was earning, and you come along and ask me for the money, and I take it out of my savings account, and I give it to you, you're not permitted to compensate me for the loss of interest that I've suffered. That's the halacha. We have a way around it, because Chazal were finding people weren't lending money. And the whole structure of business relationships were coming to a standstill. So they introduced the heter iske. And the heter iske basically is that when you come to borrow money from me, I say to you, I'm not going to lend you money, I'm prepared to invest with you. However, I'm not prepared to take the risk of losses. I don't think you're such a wonderful businessman. So instead of taking the risk of losses, I'll fix a smaller profit. I don't want your full profits. I don't want my full share of profits. But I don't want any share of losses either. So I'll take a diminished share of profits and no losses. And we'll agree to fix it at a percentage. So it comes out effectively, it's the same as an interest rate. So what I'm saying is I'm going to get 10% of the amount that I'm investing annually. Instead of the possibility of making much more than that if I was invested properly, but saving myself the risk of losing altogether if you make losses. It's called the heter iske. We convert the loan into an investment. And of course the question is asked, so what are we doing here? Are we finding ways around the Torah? Is there some kind of trick? The Torah says don't lend money on interest. So we find a whole dray that enables people to lend money on interest and not call it interest, call it an investment. What's the difference? What's the big? What are we achieving with this? But the answer is that we're achieving a lot with it. What is the whole understanding of not lending money on interest? There are a number of angles to it that need to be appreciated. The one is that the lending of money is not merely an act of business, and it's not merely an interpersonal act. There's a strange Gemara in Bava Metzia Daf Ayin Aleph that says, "Omer Rabbi Yosi." Says Rabbi Yosi, "Bo ura'e samyus enehim shel malvei beribis." Look how blind people are who lend their money on interest. Adam korei lechaveroi rosho. What would happen if you went up to somebody and you called him a rosho, a wicked person, a nobody, a so and so? Yoyred imo lechayov. He would get faribled and he would argue and he would fight and he would take great exception. The heim mevim, and these people lend money with interest. Mevim aidim, they bring witnesses. The lavla, and they bring a scribe. The kulmus, and a pen. Udyoy, and ink. The kosvin, the chosmin. And they write down and sign with witnesses. Peloni ze kofar be'elokei Yisrael. I so and so deny the God of Israel. That's what a document means. A shtar, a document with an interest loan in it, is a denial of the God of Israel. So what's going on, says Rabbi Yossi? Where's the inconsistency? If I call you a Roshua, you'll get upset. You'll take me to Beis Din for defaming you. And the next day you'll go and call yourself a Roshua in front of Eidim with the document and you'll sign, "I deny the God of Israel." What's lending of interest got to do with denying the God of Israel? We need to understand that it's not for nothing that in so many of our mitzvahs, the Ribbono Shel Olam reminds us not of the time of the creation of the world, but of the time of our coming out of Egypt. "I am the Lord, your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt, took you out of slavery," and so on. The Ten Commandments opens like that. Kiddush every Friday night in Yom Tov we say it, in the davening on Shabbos we say it. Many, many mitzvahs that we do, we mention Yetzias Mitzrayim. What was it, the coming out of Egypt? What happened there? It wasn't the creation of the people, we were created before then. It wasn't even the creation of a nation, we were a nation before then. Bnei Yisrael, the family of Yaakov who came, was already a little nation, and it grew into a nation in Mitzrayim. What was it that happened when we came out of Egypt? And not the giving of the Torah, that was 49 days later. And it doesn't say in all these mitzvahs, "I am the Lord your God who gave you the Torah." It's, "I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." The difference between a slave and a free person is that a slave can't own assets. A slave can't possess money, he can't trade on his own account. A free person can. So when the Ribbono Shel Olam took us out of Egypt, the major transformation was a commercial one. The major transformation, we were the same people. The only difference in our status from being slaves to being free people was a change in status from being unable to possess property to being able to possess property. And what's important is that that act of taking us out of Egypt, that act of making us into people who were able to possess property, was done conditionally. And that was with the understanding that the Ribbono Shel Olam remains the ultimate owner of assets. That the Ribbono Shel Olam remains the ultimate owner of capital and of property. And he gave us the capacity to own property, to own assets, and to deal in them, on condition that the most important object, or the most important purpose of that, would be to construct the nation, to construct the clan. That's what we really meant to be doing with our property. We own the property, that's true, but we own it only as curators of the Ribbono Shel Olam. He freed us from bondage, and he gave us certain rights over the money, but they are restricted rights. And one of the obligations is to support community life. It's a condition. You've got your money, but there's a condition. You have to support community life with your profit, with your money. And amounts are put down. A minimum of 10%, between 10 and 20% of your net income, your net after-tax income, has to go to supporting community life. So that's where it comes. The community is terribly important. Not more important than the individual, but at least equally important as the individual. And therefore every individual has to set aside part of his assets in order to support the community. Both to support the poor people in the community and to support the services of the community. Because otherwise a community can't function. And the Bos Eidin used to enforce that law. That was a tax. People had to understand that it wasn't fair and wasn't right. The kind of situation that you've got in South Africa today, where I forget the figures, but it's something like 70 or 80% of the charity in South Africa comes from 4 or 5 families. People say South Africa is a very charitable country and all the rest, per capita, the amount of money that we give to Israel is one of the highest in the world. That's true, but if you remove those 4 or 5 families, we're one of the lowest in the world. That needs to be known. Everybody goes around, South Africa, charitable, charitable, charitable. Not so charitable. When you remove 4 or 5 families from the scene and you divide the balance of what we're giving to Israel and to Tzedakah among the other Jews in the country, not so charitable anymore. And that applies both for local charities and for charity that's given overseas. You want to find it all over. And find it in many communities, including our own. Many, many people benefit from the services of our shul, from other shuls, but look at the people who are actually supporting it. It's disproportionate. That's not the way it's meant to be. Everybody has to support it to the same degree in terms of their ability, that is, in terms of the percentage of their own income. That has to be standard. That has to go towards supporting the community. That's one of the conditions under which the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us money. The second is that we lend money to one another interest-free. If a person doesn't lend money interest-free, then he's denying the fact that this money ultimately belongs to the Ribbono Shel Olam, because that's a condition of the Torah. Here's your money, here's your assets, the condition is that you make interest-free loans. The person doesn't, is malve beribis, that's what the Gemara means. He's declaring by giving his money an interest against the provision of the Torah that I do not acknowledge that the Ribbono Shel Olam is the owner of the money and that I'm just a manager. I begin to think that I'm the owner of the money. What would we start feeling like if our managers started handling the money as if it was their own? Forgetting that they're only managers, they're employees. You hire a person and you put him in a position of authority and you give him signing powers. All of a sudden you come along and you find he's doing what he wants with your money. And he's forgotten totally that it's not his. And he says, but I'm working very hard. Yeah, you're working hard for your salary. You're not working hard for the, this money isn't yours. So it is with ourselves. The money that we have, we manage. We don't own. That's the important understanding of all the business related halachas of the Torah. Is that they all express one common principle. And that is, we are managers, we are not owners of our own assets. The Ribbono Shel Olam owns it. There's another meaning to the laws of ribis, which Hirsch talks about very beautifully. And he says, if you deny the possibility of lending money with interest, then you are making the only means of earning profit, the only means of earning profit becomes the investment of capital and labor together. You can't make money without labor. You can't make money without entrepreneurship. There are only two ways to make money. You've either got to be a laborer yourself, you've either got to take your money and buy things with your money and sell things with your money and provide services with your money. That way you can make money. Or you've got to invest in somebody else's labor and share in the profits and the risks of that person's labor. But capital on its own then is deprived of its power. Which would, and if societies lived that way, a lot of social inequalities and injustices would be eliminated. Yes, money is very powerful and very important, but only when it's linked to human endeavor. Only when it's linked to work, to labor, to thought, to creativity. Then money becomes valuable. Money merely stuck away on a risk-free investment, that was never the Torah's intention. Torah's intention was that we use our money. Money is not a commodity. Money is not an asset. Money is a kerach. It's a power meant to be applied to the world in order to improve the world, in order to improve the society in which we operate. That's what it was meant to be. And therefore the heter iske makes sense. Because what I'm saying when I sign a heter iske is, I know that I'm not entitled to use capital as a source of income, merely to invest it in a risk-free sort of investment. What I need to do is to invest it in proper business, and that's what I'm doing. But I'm opting for a lower profit and for none of the losses. But at least mentally and emotionally, I'm relating to this loan not as capital being invested in a fixed interest type of thing. I'm relating to it as participating with you in your business. I become a partner rather than a creditor. So that there is in fact no real role of creditor in Torah society. Isn't such a thing as a creditor? You're a partner, or you're a customer, you're a supplier, or you're a partner. But there's no such thing as a creditor. There's another element to lending money with ribis or without ribis, and that is we need to understand clearly the difference between an act of business and an act of chesed. Although there's some degree of overlap, business entails a lot of chesed, entails a lot of kindness. One's providing for the needs of people, one's providing employment for people, one's providing opportunity for people. There's a great deal of chesed in business. But yet there's a difference too in perspective, and we've got to be able to see them from their different dimensions. And that is, business by its very nature involves a single transaction that needs to be entirely reciprocal. At the end of the day, both parties to the transaction need to have their needs satisfied in order for it to be a satisfactory business transaction. I provide you with a service or with goods, you provide me with payment, and we're both satisfied with the value of the transaction. Only that way is a business transaction honest and complete. So that a business transaction is the simultaneous fulfillment of the needs of both parties. I need to sell my goods, you need my goods, so your need is fulfilled and my need is fulfilled simultaneously. That's a business transaction. Chesed is a one-sided transaction. Chesed is my fulfilling your needs. Full stop. What's the difference? The difference is that with a business transaction, at the end of the transaction, both parties maintain equilibrium. At the end of the transaction, I owe you nothing and you owe me nothing. We've entered into a relationship, we conducted the relationship, and we concluded the relationship. And we're left in equilibrium. There's nothing left for you to do. In a relationship of chesed, in order to re-establish equilibrium, you need to initiate a new transaction. That's the difference. A business transaction is one-off, and a chesed transaction is one-sided and requires, in order for reciprocity to take place, and we've discussed before the importance of reciprocity, that a person mustn't be left feeling indebted. At the end of a business transaction, nobody's left feeling indebted. If somebody is left feeling indebted, it was not a successful business transaction. At the end of a business transaction, nobody should be left feeling indebted. At the end of a chesed transaction, one party should be left feeling indebted. And the result of that is that party should initiate a new transaction to rectify that indebtedness. And that's how chesed becomes dynamic. I do a chesed, leaves you indebted, you initiate a new response, you leave me indebted, and I do another one to you, and so it goes on for the rest of our lives. We're busy initiating transactions which are reciprocating and indebting at the same time. What is lending of money? Lending of money is a bit of a difficult one. Tzedakah is clearly, I give charity, that's chesed, clear chesed. Selling you goods and you're paying me goods, that's clear business. What is lending money? Is that chesed or is it business? That needs to be clarified. The Torah doesn't want there to be any grey question about that. The recipient needs to know whether he's been indulging in a business transaction or in an act of chesed. Because it makes an enormous difference to how he responds. If it's a business transaction, there's equilibrium. If it's an act of chesed, then there's a need sometime to initiate a new transaction in order to respond. And so the Torah says the lending of money is an act of chesed. The Torah does not want business to be conducted on the basis of money lending. That's not the kind of business the Torah wants. The kind of business the Torah wants is productive business. Is when business, when you take money and you apply it to labor, and there's something is produced as a result of that. That's the kind of business the Torah wants. The Torah doesn't want non-productive business. That's why, by the way, with speculation, there's no siyata dishmaya. You speculate, no siyata dishmaya. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, but there's no siyata dishmaya. But Hashem only helps when you're being productive. But when you're gambling, you're on your own. Totally on your own. Lending money is meant to be an act of chesed, not an act of business. If it's an act of chesed, you don't charge for acts of chesed. You don't charge people. You're doing an act of chesed, you don't charge for it. it's interesting that on the one hand, that means if I lend a person money, I'm making him indebted. I've done him a chesed. On the other hand, he has to be very careful how he responds. And if you look at the halachas of ribis, if you look at the laws of ribis, all that the restrictions revolve around is that his response has to be in a completely non-related area in order for it to be acceptable. If it's related to the loan in any way whatever, then he's paying interest. Then it's a business deal. If it's a chesed, then the reciprocation has to be in a completely different way altogether. Something totally different, not related, and it can't be motivated by the loan either. It's got to be motivated by other things altogether. So, for example, you don't normally send me a Rosh Hashanah card, but this year I lent you money and you feel and you send me a Rosh Hashanah card this year, that's ribis. You're not allowed to do that. Because what's motivating the Rosh Hashanah card is not that you feel for me or you love me, otherwise you would have sent it to me every year. What's making you send it? The fact that I lent you money, that's ribis. But that doesn't mean that you can never do me a chesed. That doesn't mean that you can never do me a kindness in return, as long as the kindness is in no way linked to the loan. If I'm going to charge interest, then the Torah wants us to convert that at least conceptually, if not commercially, at least conceptually, to convert that into a business deal. Because then the other person must be left without a feeling of indebtedness. It's very important. But if I'm lending you money and you're paying me interest, I can't come to you years later and say, don't ever forget what I did for you. When you were down and out, I lent you money. Forget it. When you were down and out, I did business with you and I made you pay for it. That relationship has to be clarified. People who lend money have the strange ability to inculcate into their debtors some kind of feeling of indebtedness when they're charging interest for it. That's not right. We often commented how a bank is an amazing business. It makes people, less so now than it used to be, but even now, makes people somehow feel grateful. I can only think of two businesses like that. The one is a casino, and the other is a bank. In both cases, you see the clients lining up, begging to have the opportunity to deal. In a casino, imagine such a thing. You actually see people lining up, waiting with their tongues hanging out to give their money to the owner. Just to give. And if occasionally you dish me out a little bit back, oh, boy, how wonderful. You see them sticking their money into... It's a limud. One has to go to a casino occasionally and watch people. Actually watch. Then you put the money in and you put the... The balabos is asleep somewhere. He's lying. He's playing tennis. He's swimming. And he's got thousands of people around there, busy giving him money, and every now and then he throws a few coins back at them, and they get so excited, he gave us a little bit of money back, and they give it all back to him, and they give him more, they carry on giving. It's the most wonderful business. They get nothing in return. And banks are like that a little bit too. People queuing up, lining up. What other business do you find people willing to stand in queues like that? And for what? To have the opportunity to give you my money, you can use it a little bit and you can pay me a bit of interest. Or I'll borrow money from you and I'll pay a lot of interest. Actually, line up. And when you go and you see the bank manager, I don't know how they do it, and you go and you see the bank manager with your knees shaking, and you know he won't lend you a penny unless he's secured up to the roof. You know he won't. And still your knees are shaking. Not his, your knees are shaking. And please, and you put on your best suit and you sit down and you talk to him nicely. Please, can I make use of your services? I'll pay whatever you want to, please. What other business is like that where you get people to line up for you? It's an amazing thing that a creditor has the ability to make the debtor feel as if the debtor's being done an enormous favor. Yes, if you're not charging interest, that's an incredible chesed. That's an incredible chesed. But if you're charging interest, that's business dealing. No favors at all, that's business. And I don't owe him anything, and he doesn't owe me anything. He lent me money, I'm paying him, I've got to pay him back the capital, I've got to service the loan. That's my obligation, and that's how I'll do. Finished. I don't owe him anything more than that. And so the Torah wants that at least, if we're lending money in interest, it's clarified with absolute clarity to both parties that the loan is not an act of chesed, it's not an act of kindness, it's an act of business. But getting back to the interest-free loan, which is an act of kindness, an act of chesed. Why the racism? Why only to a Jew and not to a non-Jew? If it's such a wonderful thing to lend money without interest, why shouldn't we feel for the hardship of a non-Jewish person who's struggling
and who needs the money? He's a human being, suffering, in anguish, worried.
Surely it's just as proper for us to lend him money too. So the halacha is that that applies to the Jewish people only. Why? There needs to be understood that there is a difference in the way we relate to family and the way we relate to outsiders. Relate to family differently. To make money on family members is not right. If you have a close member of your family who wants to buy something from you, you sell it to him at cost. You don't make a profit on him. But that doesn't mean that applies to everybody. So is it moral to make a profit or isn't? If it's moral to make a profit, why shouldn't I make a profit out of family members too? And if it's immoral, then why should I make a profit out of anybody? The answer is no, it depends with who. If it's an ordinary person with whom you don't have a close family relationship, of course you're providing a service and you charge for it. But for a family member, it's not right. We did some interesting research at the Institute of Business Ethics on the effect on loyalty of employees to their company when that loyalty conflicts with loyalty to close friends or family. And we found that even employees who are fiercely loyal to their companies, that loyalty goes down to zero when the loyalty conflicts with loyalty to fellows. And that's one of the problems in South Africa, for example, with economic crime. The only really effective way to counteract economic crime is if you've got people in the organization who are willing to report it. It's the only way you can really get to grips with it. And we're finding that people are not willing to report it. Because generally, people have a closer relationship with a criminal. People in the organization have a closer relationship with a criminal. They've worked with him all these years. They sympathize. They know his life story. They get on well with him. They have a closer relationship with their fellow employee than they do with the company. And so if they see somebody else doing something he oughtn't to be doing, their tendency is to keep quiet, and they feel more of a loyalty to their friend than to the company. What I've had to deal with is the perception that this applies particularly among the black people. And it is so in a sense, because one black person won't easily report on his fellow black person, even if he doesn't know him that well. And white business sees that as a terrible problem and is terribly immoral. And they're battling with that. So what I've had to do is take people through a process whereby we examine what would they do if they were working and their brother was working, real brother was working in the same place, and their brother was stealing. And they knew that if they reported their brother, he would lose his job. And they knew that their brother was struggling for a living, that their brother had a large family to support, and that they hardly came out at the end of the month. And he knew that there's a recession on, and that if he reported his brother and his brother lost his job, his brother would not easily or probably never get another job. Imagine such a situation. So most of the honest white people admit they wouldn't report. They would counsel the brother, they would try and persuade the brother to give the money back, they would do all sorts of things, but they wouldn't report. And we go into a long discussion, which I can't go into now, as to whether that's moral or immoral, whether that's right or wrong. After all, there's a law, there's a condition of your employment that you would report crime. Is it right that because it's your brother, you don't report him? That's a whole discussion all on its own. But the next question is, and what happens if it's your cousin? So most white people say, no, if it's my cousin, I report. Brother, no. Cousin, yes. Then I say to them, and if I would tell you that I wouldn't report my cousin either, would you say I'm more moral or less moral? Because I feel my cousin to be part of my family. Is that a greater level of morality or a lower level of morality?
I've got to acknowledge that's greater morality. That means I identify with my cousin the way I identify with my brother. And then I say to them, if I would tell you that I wouldn't report a fellow Jew, even if he's not my cousin, is that a greater morality or a lesser morality? And I have to say it's a greater morality. That means I regard every Jew as my brother. And if I tell you that one black man won't report on another black man because he regards him as his brother, is that a greater morality or a less morality? By now there's nothing you can do. They've been caught. And they've got to acknowledge, as the argument has gone to such a point where you've got to acknowledge that the unwillingness of the black man to report his fellow black man is a greater morality than the willingness of the white man to report his fellow white man. That doesn't mean it's right, but one has to deal with that. You can't just accept such a situation because things come to a standstill if one does, and there are things to do about it. But that feeling of I act towards him the same way as I act towards my brother is an extension of family. And extending the family is a greater act of morality, not a lesser act of morality. The Rabbeinu Bechaya says on this posuk, the Dorshu Razal and the Chachomim have learned on this posuk, Loisashich Leochicho. You may not charge interest to your brother. This is a family law. That's all. Would you charge interest if you lend money to your real brother? Would you charge interest? Would you charge interest if you lend money to your father or to your son? I know many people do, but what's normal? To charge interest, you wouldn't, because that's close family. You need to know that any Jewish person is ochicho. We need to learn to develop a feeling of family to any Jewish person. Now, I think I've mentioned before, but it's critical to be aware of this, that I was in Israel when the Intifada started. And I saw a television program in Israel less than a week before the Intifada started, where young Israelis were interviewed and they were asked, if a train drew up, an empty train, except there were two people, one in one carriage and one in another carriage. In the one carriage was a chosid from Mea Shorim, and in the other carriage was an Arab. Which carriage would you feel more comfortable sitting in? And all of them, one after the other, they interviewed tens of them, said, I would sit in the carriage with the Arab. Feel more comfortable. But less than a week after that, the Intifada started. One has to understand what a sense of brotherhood is. It doesn't mean that I love my brother. It doesn't mean that I agree with him. It doesn't mean that I want to spend the rest of my life next to him. But there's such a thing as a brother. There's such a thing as a family relationship. And a family relationship has to mean something. And what it really means is, if you're in trouble, I'll be there. That's what it means. We don't have to live on top of each other. We don't have to be talking to each other every day. That's not necessary for family. What family does mean is, if you're in trouble, I'm there. What family does mean, if I have to choose somebody, if I'm stuck on a desert island and there's only one person I can be with, I would rather be with family. If I'm in trouble, I would rather have family with me. That's what family means. One needs to understand that feeling of family. And when you're lending money, somebody's in trouble. If it's a member of family, you don't charge him. If it's a member of family, you're there to help him. That's what a family is. It's a law, chicho. This is a family law. This is not a business law. There's nothing wrong with charging interest in business. There's nothing wrong at all. The creditor agrees an amount. The debtor agrees an amount. Both are very happy. It's an ordinary transaction. It's like any other sale or hiring of anything else. I'm allowing you to use my money for a period of time. You need to pay rental on it. That's all. The same as if you use my house, you need to pay rental. The same as if you hire my car, you need to pay rental. What's the difference? There's nothing wrong from a business point of view. There's nothing immoral in charging interest and in paying interest. There's nothing immoral at all. It's normal business. It's only immoral if you do it to a member of your family. That's when it becomes immoral. And lo'ochicho, if it's your brother, you don't charge interest. And what we need to be able to do is expand our sense of brotherhood to include the Jewish people. But Rabbeinu Bechaya goes on to say that this excludes Ulohitzi Zaroi Shel Esav, but not the descendants of Esav. What is a family? Who is this feeling of loyalty to be directed towards? Who are the people we need to feel this way about? What about Esav? What about Esav? It's a brother? How do we feel about Esav? A lot of people say, and with some foundation, that Germany are descendants, the German people are descendants of Esav. Maybe right. Let's say they are. Are they our brothers? Are we supposed to feel that same sense of brotherhood? The Arabs? Yishmael, that come from Yishmael, that are brothers? Are we meant to feel that same sense of brotherhood? And particularly since we say even in our Seder this week, Lois Sa'iv Adomi, you may not despise an Adamite, descendant of Esav. Why? Because he's your brother. You can't despise family members. You don't have to love them, but you can't despise them. Lois Sa'iv Adomi, because he's your brother, just a few psukim earlier. So if an Adomi is your brother, surely I mustn't lend money on interest to him as well. Says Rabbeinu Bechaya, no, they're excluded. Why are they excluded? Even though it says in earlier on in Bamidbar, I am your brother Yisrael, it became permitted later on. And Rabbeinu Bechaya quotes from a pasuk in Ovadia, where the Novi says, "Beyoyim amodcho mineged," when you Esav stood watching opposite. On the day when strangers plundered the wealth of Israel, and strange people came to his gates, to the gates of Yerushalayim, the Ar Yerushalayim Yadu Goyro, and on Yerushalayim they drew lotteries to decide how to divide Yerushalayim up in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, and you stood there, Esav, and you did nothing. Gam ato ke'achad mehem, you are now considered like one of them. Standing by and watching, you're considered like one of them. You resigned from the family. A family member doesn't behave like that. Not only doesn't a family member harm another member of the family, but if he sees somebody else harming him, he climbs in. If you stand and watch a member of your family being oppressed, you've resigned from the family. And so we have a new concept that familial relationships are not permanent. That familial relationships are not governed only by biology. That there's such a thing as an individual or a nation resigning from a familial relationship by acting in a way which is not familial. If you stand by and you watch the oppression of one of the members of your family, you've pulled out of the family. And with it go all the privileges of being part of the family. And therefore Esav, the descendants of Esav, are not included in this halacha, and one is permitted to charge them interest. Limedecho, the Torah teaches us, shekvar nisbatlo ha'achvo v'yotzo michlolo, that the achvo, the brotherhood, has been cancelled and he has removed himself from it. V'hareihu kisha'ar ha'umois hazorim, and he becomes like any other strange nation, an outsider. Shehare haribis le'nesa li'Yisrael elomitam shnitztavinu la'achayosu v'la'asis imoy gemilus chasodim. The reason that ribis is not allowed for a fellow Jew is because we've been commanded to take care of his life and to do chesed, to do kindness to fellow Jews. This is part of the laws of kindness, not the laws of business. There's nothing inherently wrong with charging interest. It's just that it's an act of kindness not to charge interest, and we are obligated to be kind to one another. Mimasha Kosov, and what's the obligation of chesed? V'chai achicho imoch, and your brother should live with you. So we see in the Rabbeinu Bechaya that not only is not charging interest a familial law, that all the laws of chesed are familial laws. All the laws of kindness. That doesn't mean one oughtn't to be kind to other people. But the principle, the moral underlying principle of chesed is a familial relationship, identification with the other person. Otherwise, what is the reason for doing a chesed? Doing a chesed is a very strange thing. Making a sacrifice for somebody else, it goes against everything. It goes against all the rules of business. It goes against all the rules of psychology. And I'm not talking about a chesed that you do to somebody in anticipation of payment later on. That's politics, that's not chesed. Chesed is when you do something for another person without any expectations of any kind of reciprocity, whatever. That's chesed. And that's superhuman. That's not something that a human being naturally does, it's not part of his natural instinct. to make sacrifices without any expectations whatever. That is only expected for family members. That is realistic. That kind of self-sacrifice we're meant to show to other members of our family that is Yisrael. What about a Jew who doesn't behave like a Jew? So Esav, we know, excluded himself as a nation. Can an individual also exclude himself? So on the one hand, we have the principle that Yisrael, afal pi shechoto, Yisrael hu. A Jew, even if he sins, he's still a Jew. You can't resign from the Jewish people. No matter what you do, once a Jew, always a Jew. Does that extend, therefore, always a Jew, then always a brother? The answer is no, explains Rabbeinu Bechaya, this is Paskin in Shulchan Aruch. V'chein ha-meshumad la'avodah zarah. And so if somebody is a meshumad, if he gives up his Yiddishkeit, we don't recognize that. If a person converts to another religion, we don't recognize that conversion. Yisrael afal pi shechoto Yisrael, he remains a Jew forever. He cannot give up his Judaism. But he does give up his rights to membership of the family. And mutar la'avodah b'ribus, you can lend money on interest to him. That applies not only to somebody who gives up his religion formally, but somebody who gives up his religion informally too. And that's defined in the halacha as a person who knows, who's learned, not an ignoramus, somebody who knows what it's all about and has been given the opportunity to appreciate the Torah, and if given, as one sometimes finds on some of the flights going outside of Israel, they dress the kosher meals up to look exactly the same as the trefa meals. So that, you know, not on the, on LL, that's all kosher meals, but on the other airlines, they've got control over the kitchen, so you have a choice. And there's no difference. The two meals come, and if the one wouldn't be sealed, you wouldn't know that the one was kosher and that the other one was treif. And they come with two, you know, because they don't know who's taking kosher, who's not. If a flight out of Israel, it's such a mishmash, and everybody, there's so many people taking kosher, they prepare a lot of kosher, and they prepare non-kosher as well. And they come to you with a tray very often, with a kosher meal and a treifa meal, and they ask, which one do you want? And many people who don't even keep kosher say, oh, the kosher one. But you find people who choose the treifa one. Sometimes it's ignorant people who don't understand what kashrus is and what Torah is, but sometimes it's not such ignorant people. Such a person is also a mumma. He's resigned from the family. He hasn't resigned from being Jewish. But if you're given the option of two equal things and you deliberately do the wrong one, knowing that it's wrong, then you're resigning from the family. That's not a member of the family anymore. And that's paskin in the halacha, that such a person, one can lend money with interest and borrow money with interest. Not always both of them, there are technical problems involved, but essentially the law of interest doesn't apply from the point of view of the lender when the borrower is somebody who's resigned from the family. That takes care of why it is that we're not obligated to lend interest free to non-Jews. Not part of the family, this is a familial law. They can make their own laws, as the Muslims have, that they also don't lend with interest to one another, and the Christians could do the same. And the Zulus can do the same. Anybody's free to make such a law that when we're lending to each other, it's without interest. The Jews have done that among themselves. It's a familial law. It's not a business law. It's not a question of morality and ethics. It's a familial law that we don't want to make money out of members of the family, and we call any fellow Jew a member of the family. That's how we feel about each other. But briefly and finally, it doesn't explain the Rambam's view. The Rambam's view is that you've got to charge interest to a non-Jew. Where does that come from? It's not la halacha, that's not the halacha. The halacha is you're free to do it as you want. But still the view of the Rambam is that you've got to charge interest to a non-Jew. Ron, so can you pass me that Minchas Chinuch, the brown sofa on the corner there? That's it. Thank you very much. And here the Sefer HaChinuch explains the Shita of the Rambam, as he follows the same view. In Mitzvah Taf Kuf Ayin Gimel, he says, She'ein roi lonu ligmol chesed zulosi el ha'om yoidei hakel v'oivdim lefonav. We are only supposed to do chesed to those people who know God and serve Him. Uvehimana ha'chesed misha'al b'nei ha'odom v'na'aseh otoy le'ilu. And by not doing chesed to others and only to these, nivchon ki iker ha'avo v'achem lo aleim mitzad echzikim b'toras elokim yizborach. We are showing that the essence of this love and sympathy for them is because they keep the Torah. And if you understand this, not doing chesed of this kind, and remember I've defined chesed as a totally selfless act of kindness in expectation of no reciprocity at all. By doing that only, by not doing that to non-Jews, it's as much of a mitzvah as doing it to Jews. Now, imagine anything as racist as that. What does it mean? That according to the Shita of the Chinuch and the Rambam in this area, it's actually a mitzvah. What kind of a mitzvah is it? Explains the Chinuch. Our feeling for other people is not based just on family. There's a value judgment. There's a difference between the way you feel for somebody and how you express that. For example, you might look at a little puppy and you might think to yourself, shame and beautiful and lovely. And if the little puppy cries, you get sad for the little puppy. And if the puppy's got nothing to eat, you really get very sad. It's quite, and one becomes quite attached. But if we went round in the Beis HaMedrash and I said, you know, there's a mashulach here raising money. Yeah, yeah, what's it for? There's a family of puppies down the road. But they're not making it. The EPO rations have decreased and they're in need. We wouldn't raise all that much money. Why not? Not because people don't sympathize, not because people don't feel. But there's a difference between feeling and sympathizing and translating that into an action where one has limited resources and you have to decide where do those resources go. When you do a chesed, you're not just sympathizing. Sympathizing is a feeling. And sharing a load with somebody and talking nicely to a person, that's sympathizing. But an act of chesed, particularly of monetary value, is an expression of value. You're saying to the person, not only do I sympathize with you, but I value you also. That's the important thing. I'm prepared to make a sacrifice for you because you're valuable to me. So explains the Chinuch, chesed is not meant to be a way of expunging some kind of guilt feeling. Chesed is not meant to be a way of just expressing sympathies. I feel sorry, so let me give you a few pennies and now that makes me feel a little bit better. That's not what chesed is. Chesed is a demonstration of the extent to which I value you. Not just sympathy. And valuing you has to be tied to who you are and what you stand for. If you value everybody the same, then you value nobody. If there is distinction in the way you value people, then it's true valuing. And says the Chinuch, our means of expressing the way we value people is by the kind of chesed we're willing to do. Not by our feelings. Of course we're meant to sympathize. Of course we're meant to empathize. But the expression of that in a material form of an act of chesed, that's much more than sympathizing and empathizing. And that we reserve as the highest expression of saying, I value what you stand for. Not just I value you, I value what you stand for. Now, people are feeling guilty and confused about what the Serbs are doing to the Muslims in Yugoslavia or in what was Yugoslavia. And you get different things are said. And one of the things that are said is, isn't the world doing the same as they did in the late 1930s and the 1940s? Aren't they standing by and watching the annihilation of innocent people? And the world gets very guilty when you say that. But there is a difference. The difference is when those Muslims are in control, they wiped out many Serbs. They wiped out cities too. It's now that the Serbs have gotten strong and have turned the tables and that they're mercilessly wiping out the Muslims. But the Muslims weren't such tzaddikim. There are many villages that were totally wiped out, men, women and children, by the Muslims. That could never be said about the Jews in the 1940s. The Jews of Europe never wiped anybody out. The Jews of Europe never killed anybody. They never hurt anybody. That's why the world is held to blame for what they did then. Not because they stood by while a nation was being exterminated. They stood by while an innocent nation was being exterminated. And as much as one has to feel for what's happening in Yugoslavia and many other parts of the world, what would we be saying if we now started raising money to help the poor Muslims? What would we be saying? We value you, Muslims. Why are we valuing you? Because you never go on the bottom now. You're being slaughtered. But that's not valuing, that's sympathizing. To sympathize with the underdog, that's fine. But if you're going to express value for him, you're saying much more than that. Then you've got to look at him at the way he behaved when he wasn't an underdog before you value him. What kind of a mensch were you? Hey, we don't get that. That's not the same. When you weren't the underdog, you were busy wiping other people out. To take money, to take assets and pour it in to saving a nation who themselves have been degenerate. That we don't have to do. And nor with individuals. We can feel for somebody who's having a tough time. But if he's a mushkhas, if he's a degenerate person, or it's a degenerate nation, we don't translate that into material form. That we don't do. And so if nations, and bear in mind in the time of Chazal, the non-Jewish nations were all idol worshippers. It's not quite like it is today, where the non-Jewish nations, to some degree at least, acknowledge the Ribbono Shel Olam. But at that time they were idol worshippers. They were extremely damaging and harmful in many cases to the Jewish people and to one another. There was no moral standard whatever. If we would then act in a way of chesed towards them, we would be devaluing the value of chesed. If you dish out chesed indiscriminately, your chesed means nothing. If you choose who the beneficiaries of your chesed means a great deal. And explains that the chinuch, our purpose is to use chesed as a means of showing how we value people who value the Ribbono Shel Olam, who value God and the morality of the Torah. That's what we do chesed. It's in reciprocity, not for what I get from you. I do kindness to you in reciprocity for who you are, for what you do for God, for what you do for the Torah. That's why I'm helping you. I'm an agent of God. I'm not a free agent. The money isn't mine, it's God's. So if I'm lending you money or giving you money, I'm giving the Ribbono Shel Olam. Am I entitled to give God's money to people who deny God? Am I permitted to take God's money and give it to people who exterminate God's people? Of course not. This is the Ribbono Shel Olam's money. And I can therefore only use it to show chesed to people who recognize the Ribbono Shel Olam. And so we see that there's a difference between feelings and translation of those feelings into chesed. But feelings, yes, we're meant to feel for anybody who's suffering, any human being who's suffering, and even for animals who suffer. One has to feel. We feel for suffering. And how do we feel? What strength of feeling do we have? The closer it is to home, the more we feel. That's natural. And the extent of the feeling ought to be as Moshe felt for Miriam. I know what it feels like. It's as if it's happening to me. That's what it needs to be. But when it comes to translating that into action, there are differences between family members and non-family members if we take the view of the Ramban, of Nachmanides and others. Then we're saying, yes, not lending money on interest is an act of chesed, and that's a familial law that applies to family. Non-members of family, we're free to do as we please. If we want to lend without interest, we lend without interest. We want to lend with interest, we lend with interest. That just depends on the way we feel. But then we have the view of the Rambam and the Chinuch that is known, even more than that, more extreme. We are not free to show financial forms of kindness to people who don't recognize the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because the reason for showing that kindness is to show how much we value their spirituality, how much we value their morality. And to use God's resources to assist and support people who deny God, that is not something that we're free to do. We don't have that right of ownership over the assets to be able to do that. Which leaves us with those two views. And the way we paskin is like the view of the Ramban, that we are permitted to charge interest to non-Jews, but we're not obligated to charge interest to non-Jews. That just depends on the relationship that exists. Feelings of sympathy and empathy always need to be. The translation of those feelings into monetary and material forms depends on the familial closeness. Familial closeness is determined by two elements, by the mother and by the father. Maternal familial closeness is a biological fact. Paternal familial closeness is an ideological fact. A child has a relationship with his father if he shares the same ideology. A child has a relationship with his mother irrespective of the ideology. True brotherhood is a brotherhood of both father and mother, a full brotherhood, where the person is both physically related to me, atzmi, v'sori, is part of my bones and flesh, and he shares my ideology. That's a proper achicho, that's a proper brother. And we have to relate to him in a very different way. A brother who is only biological but has abandoned the ideological brotherhood, we don't owe him any brotherhood at all. He's still a Yisrael, he's still a Jew, he's a biological Jew, but he's not an ideological Jew. And therefore the brotherhood is broken down. And a person who isn't part of the family at all certainly doesn't have that same kind of feeling of family identification, and there we're free to feel the sympathy and the empathy that we can, and we're free according to the halacha to translate that into action. But we're not obligated to treat such people as members of family, merely to treat them as fellow human beings with all the dignity and the respect that they require, but not with the total identification that one would reserve for members of family. With that, we begin to see not only the morality of Torah, but also its reality. How there is no attempt ever on the part of the Torah to impose a feeling or a practice on the human being that is unnatural, that he doesn't have the normal capacity to achieve. And yet the demands of the Torah are, while not superhuman, are certainly demands of nobility. And part of the demands of nobility include the understanding of achichohu, that your fellow Jew, if he identifies with the ideology, is achicho, is a member of your family.